In the studio, I've got Rick Thorpe. Good morning, Rick.
Yeah, atamari. Morning, Aaron. Morning, Raglan.
So, do you feel a lighter man, a weight's off your shoulders now, free, or cast adrift? How does it feel?
No longer
be officially part of Extreme.
Yeah.
Well, actually, no, that's not true, because you're still on the board, aren't you? You're going to be on the board.
I guess you're never really, you know, you're always connected in some way, but
yeah.
We had the most amazing farewell on Friday night from Extreme Zero Waste after 22 years working there.
How did it feel being the centre of attention like that?
It was awful. Yeah,
I was watching you. I wasn't watching people talk. I was watching your reactions.
That would have to be, you know, my most uncomfortable place, you know, that kind of, centre of attention.
And not just that, but people came from a long way. Like, I think, was it Cliff from Kaitaia? Cliff Calhoun was... he probably came the furthest.
Yeah. And Sue Coates from Wanaka Waste Busters.
Did she come up?
She's now working under contract in Wellington.
Okay. All right. So. All over the motu.
Yeah.
Cool. And but you lived through it.
Yeah, I survived. Oh, it was amazing. It was a great celebration of Extreme, you know, in 22 years and 450 or so people who have worked in the organisation. Everyone's contributed something towards it, you know, and so for me it was a celebration of the organisation and the distance we've travelled, the fact that there's now 75, you know, to 80% diversion of waste to landfill, and that fact that it's becoming normalised and you know, we've been enjoying a contract as an independent advisor to Auckland Council to help them develop 21 centres. So, you know, we've done well. You know, we need to celebrate as a community.
And you're still going to be doing that work, advising Auckland Council and others?
Yep.
But technically, who are you working for?
I'm really not sure.
Somebody must know.
Yeah.
So someone's got to pay you, perhaps, or not. I don't know.
Yeah, no. That particular contract's through the Zero Waste Network. And so I'm still a trustee on the Zero Waste Network and also with Extreme Zero Waste. So I'll still stay connected to the activity, but respectfully step back, you know, from the day-to-day decision-making, because it can be done so much better by Steve and Nikki and Nina and the rest of the team. They've got it nailed, and, you know, it's, I think, important to step aside, you know, create a vacuum to allow some space for other people to come step up. And I think that Extreme's in a good position. You know, as I said, zero waste is kind of normalised in terms of a goal for councils. And also, you know, there's the kind of economics of Extreme. You know, there's stronger premiums paid on product, and you know, councils willing to pay for the service, like food waste, which is, you know, going to become mandatory anyway in a couple of years' time. But that kind of, you know, that normalisation of it through central and local government just means that they're not as precarious in terms of the finances as they used to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's been part of Extreme's experience. But let's go all the way back to the start.
Ooh.
The legend is that
when
you had a fringe. Actually, we did see some. Rick's son Zach produced some photos for our viewing pleasure. Rick's leaving too, and there was one particularly spectacular '80s outfit. I remember wearing colours like that, but no one's got photos of it, as far as I know. So
yeah, you're lucky.
That was spectacular. Yeah, I tried to do a similar thing with my father when he turned 60, but he was actually. He wasn't in the country. I had all these plans. I was going to do this big slideshow of these pictures of him when he was younger. But so I made a website because the internet had just sort of come around. So managed to reach him that way. Anyway, but so the story of Extreme, this is kind of part of the legend is that Fire Eva Rickard, you went to see her one day and said that, what can we do about the harbour? And she directed you to sort out the rubbish dump. Mm. But there was also, I know there was also a community meeting about it as well around the same time. So do you remember the moment it started for you?
Yeah, I think at the kind of in the through the 80s and in early 90s, I was working for Department of Conservation, and in that work, I had been specialising in endangered species, and then I moved into marine reserves and helped set up a marine reserve at Hahe on the Coromandel Peninsula, and in partnership with Ngāti Hē. And then I started working on marine mammal strandings and coming up with a kind of protocol based around some amazing work that was done on the East Coast by a gentleman who used to work actually for Napier for Marineland, but, you know, his love of dolphins and whales meant that he could no longer work there. So that formed the basis of stranding manual and is used to today. But I was really I wanted to work on projects that were kind of in partnership with community and also partnership with mana whenua, you know, that honoured the treaty and the way that it was spelled out in the Conservation Act. But at that time, the Department of Conservation weren't as keen on kind of sharing those resources in the decision making, and so I was considering, you know, what are my other options if I left DOC. And in 1991, Lizzie and I got pregnant with Zach, and, you know, we bought the land. In 1991, we bought the land, and then in 1993, Zach was born.
Yeah.
And it was just after Zach was born, sort of probably around 1994, and that he was actually down at the Kohanga Reo, and Eva had sponsored him. She said, "Oh, waste of time working with you, Rick. You're too old, and you know, I'm going to skip a generation and work with this one." Bless her. And in many ways, she was right, you know. But it was at that time, and I said, "Look, I've got a background in marine biology. I'm really keen to work in the harbour." And she said, "Look, there's major land-based issues, places like the dump that are leaching into this harbour. That's the place to start. You know, if you want to work and improve the harbour quality, then you need to go up and close the landfill and stop the leachate." And then, the following year we went to Fiji for 2 years working for Worldwide Fund for Nature and on some amazing partnership programs. And then we went to Rarotonga for another year. And in that time, all of our trees, all of our shelter trees that we had planted on the farm were growing because it was 100% pasture when we got there. And when we came back in 1998 and pregnant with Pania, that was the time that the landfill was closing. And it just seemed right, you know. All I could think of was Fire Eva's, challenge, you know, was, the landfill needed to be closed and the leachate needed to be stopped coming into the harbour. And so it was at that time that I joined the public meetings and put my hand up, you know, was amongst others, PJ and Pini and Tuihana and Katarina Mataira and so many others.
And There was an Australian guy who came over and had a job in New Zealand going around like a zero waste evangelist or a recycling evangelist.
Jerry Gillespie.
That's right. When I made the film about Extreme, everyone said, "Oh, Jerry Gillespie." They mentioned his name, and so he must have had quite an effect.
Yeah.
When he came to town and it and
yeah. Yeah, he's still doing amazing things with the rehabilitation of old farmland in Australia. You know, land that's been thrashed By monocropping.
Was he working on that now?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of work to do in Australia on that, because the Australian countryside really hasn't handled the so-called modern farming techniques.
No, that's right. And he's coming up with really simplistic methods, like kind of aerial top dressing, worm castings, you know, that are resetting microbiological life, you know, and just from that one little casting per square meter is enough to sort of restart that whole process of rehabilitation.
Actually, that's something that when you look at the people doing environmental repair, that's something you discover. And a lot of people be out somewhere else saying, oh, no, to regenerate life in the harbour, it's going to be so expensive. You have to do so many things. But what like Harbour Care's discovered and what you've just described is if you find the right starting point and just give it a little nudge, nature takes over.
Yeah.
And just builds on itself from there.
Yeah, agree. And in some of the protected areas, you know, whether they be formerly marine protected areas or Rahui, but it takes once you get down to almost zero fish life, it takes very, very little effort to keep them at zero. But as soon as you take that pressure off, you know, then nature is, is given that opportunity to regenerate, and they, yeah, it's incredible.
Programmed to respond, like just head toward abundance.
Yeah.
So at what point did you realise that extreme waste was going to take over your life?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I still, in those early years, had that image of myself swanning around, you know, in an inflatable boat doing marine biology type activities in the harbour.
Yeah.
And so this was, you know, just a small part of it. But, yeah, it was obvious in that first year of activity that this project was as much about the social and the local economics as it was about the environment.
So I should leap in here and just tell people that although Extreme officially started in the year 2000, a group of you had spent, and you and your family spent 2 years voluntarily picking up recycling in the community. So and at some point must have decided you needed the council contract to do the job properly.
Yeah.
So it must have been around then that it started to look like it might become a career. When did you think it was going to? When did you know it was going to be your career, Rick?
Well, I don't think I ever really did. You know, I just did what was necessary at the time. You know, to make it happen. And as you say, it took 2 years. Really, we were all ready to go in 1999.
Yeah,
and then some council just at the last minute said, oh no, we've hired someone else to actually run the transfer station.
And that was the year the transfer station started, wasn't
it? Yes, it was, yeah, 1999.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, there was, you know, look, a big mihi to the Lions. The Lions Club were doing a voluntary paper and cardboard collection at the curbside, you know, house to house, as well as picking up paper and cardboard from the businesses. And they were taking that down to a large container, a modified sea freight container, which was parked up down at the wharf. And they would load that in, and kind of once a month or once every second month, that container would go up to Paper Reclaim in Auckland. And so there was a small income there for the Lions. And so... PJ and Pinney and myself, we jumped in and helped the Lions with those curbside collections, and felt, yes, this is good. Our community is used to this activity, you know, of doing something within the household, but collectively creating a volume of a resource. And so that was sort of woven into the first designs of maybe we could pick up other things while we were picking up paper and cardboard. And so they for the Waikato, Raglan and Extreme Zero Waste set up the first recycle collection, which was done with crates, and we collected glass, aluminium cans, plastics and paper cardboard.
Well, when I got here in 2000, that was what was happening. We probably presumed that it was just, we thought this is cool, there's recycling in this town. We had no idea it had just started.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were into it when we were young, then it just seemed perfectly normal to recycle.
Yep.
Was there a model for Extreme anywhere that you were looking at and going, we're trying to do that?
Yeah, there was. We were lucky. At the very beginning, there were three community resource recovery centres, one at Ashburton, one at Kaikoura, and one in Kaitaia, Cliff Calhoun's that you mentioned before.
Yeah.
And Cliff's had been going for longer than most. Cliff and Warren Snow, with the support of Jerry Gillespie, had set up CBEC, or the Community Business Environment Centre.
Yeah.
And they had contracts with council to run the transfer station, resource recovery centre, as well as doing curbside collection. So we kind of took that model.
So did they invent the model, or had they worked out, had they seen what happens in other places overseas, or is this something that just evolved?
Yeah, so, the cities, New Zealand cities, there were a few of them that had curbside collection at that stage.
But of recyclables?
Yeah, of recyclables.
Okay, so some councils were actually doing it.
Yeah, some councils were doing the curbside collections, and then... but there were no resource recovery centres, so there were only those three. If you couldn't put it out on the curbside in terms of a recyclable, then you needed to take it up to the transfer station. And at best, those ones only really had diversion of metal because it was high premium in those days.
Yeah. All right. So we get to 1st of July 2000 and an Extreme starts. And how busy were you then?
Yeah, very busy. And, a real learning curve. There was, so much to be done. I mean, I can remember applying for funding to try and get a truck. And I think it was Perry's that actually we applied for $20,000 and they gave us five. Mm-hmm. And so we sent them a photo of a wheel and said that we were, looking forward to getting the other 15,000, so that we could attach it to a chassis, They quite enjoyed the joke and were more generous, in some future years.
Right.
But we, with 5,000 from Perry's, we then went to the regional council and said, would you match us dollar for dollar? And so we turned that into 10. And then we went to the district council and said, would you match us dollar for dollar? We've got 10,000. And that's how we got the first $20,000 in a truck.
Right.
And I think we did modifications to that truck up at our place in the garage. And we hit the road the next day doing curbside collections.
It all seems very precarious at the start.
Yeah.
Did it feel precarious?
It was, yeah. It was really touch and go. And look, there were many months when the managers, didn't get paid. We didn't have the cash flow to be able to withstand things like, a late payment from council, and it might be, late by a month. But that, for us, that was crippling, So our reserves were really tiny, and we didn't have that initial investment. And there was a lot of people who really felt, I think, that it was great that community was were passionate and taking an interest, but really, this lied within the realm of international waste companies. They're the ones that had all of the contracts in the other places. So, really it was, I think there were many people waiting for us to fail.
At council?
And throughout,
We know that the relationship with council wasn't good for a while to start with, and that you guys were viewed with a lot of skepticism.
That's right. Yeah, and 1 year contracts. For the first 7 years, we just have 1 year contracts, and they're just crippling. You can't go to a bank and say, we've got the security of a long term contract, and therefore we'd like to borrow money. Against it, we just had these. We're just limping from year to year with these single year contracts. It wasn't a great way, and what we've learned and the best centres that are set up around the country now are done with 10-year leases, and 3-year funding contracts, so they're set up in a way that they can capitalize in their first year, and they can have all of the facilities and the equipment which they need.
Yeah, and that was an issue for Extreme, wasn't it? The equipment was legendary.
And it's
useless. Well, not, it wasn't totally useless, but
yeah. Look, it was. We just had to make do with what we had. And so, yeah, then you were kind of viewed through this kind of, are you being professional, in the business? And whereas, all of these plans, health and safety plans, and where's your training systems, and who are the people that you're choosing to work with? Well, Work and Income New Zealand gave us the most unemployable people in Raglan to begin with, because they just couldn't find jobs for them, or the people, there was a mismatch of desire to work and opportunity. And yet those people were amazing. They truly were. And sure, we had to teach literacy and numeracy and help them with their finances and get rid of their, their debts. And
so this is pastoral care.
It is, but from
the employer, you guys as the employer.
So many of the people that, 450-odd people that have come in and out of Extreme, they would leave our school with very poor literacy and numeracy. Yeah. And it wasn't that they were, weren't intelligent people. They just had slipped through the system. And so Extreme was another way of doing that, another way of supporting them. And giving them the confidence in many respects to be able to take on the challenges of life.
So, how many times did you feel like, did you think, it's going to come all crashing down in those early years?
Yeah, look, we were never that close. With community enterprise, the ultimate card that you can pull is the support of your community.
Yeah.
And that did happen, when bless him, Warwick Bennett, the CEO of Waikato District Council, he had done a deal with Waste Management for 15 years of contract over the whole district.
So Extreme had been doing the contract for how long at that point?
We'd been doing, I think, for a couple of years at that stage.
Yeah.
And doing really well. And so he just wiped us out completely and just rang us up and said, look, don't turn up after 1st of July. Waste Management would be taken over. And so I wandered down here, and there was a Grey Power meeting, I think, at the community house, and had a chat to them, and they were really upset. They love to see the local people running on the truck. They love to see the resources being picked up. They had lived, through the war, many of those people, and they weren't wasteful. They were resourceful, and they wanted a system that honoured that. And so they got really angry, and they pretty much blocked the phone lines into district council. This is pre internet. So there was only 3 phone lines, and anyway, we managed to block council offices from operating phones in or out for a couple of days. And that's finally they took us seriously and said, okay, well, we're going to carve Raglan off, and you'll be your own. You can do your thing over there, and the rest of the district will stay with Waste Management.
Because their view was that it was more expensive. It was cheaper to have a corporate running it than a community group.
Yeah, that's right. And they really just wanted the minimum. They just wanted a few things picked up at the curbside, and then the rest of the waste transferred to landfill, to Horatiu at that time.
One of the things that, for people who don't know, I talk about it a lot, so most of your listeners probably do know, I made a film about Extreme Waste in 2014. But I was looking at how to describe the financial difference for the community with it, like having Waste Management or a big corporate crowd doing it compared to Extreme. And of course, the corporation's very good at sucking monies out of communities, whereas a community group, part of the purpose is a community enterprise, part of the purpose is to leave the money here.
Mm.
And so I decided to look at it as the rates as an investment by the community.
Nice.
And so for, I think at that time, it was about, I think I was using the 2012 accounts, the rates were around about $400,000 going into Extreme. And then the money spent back into the community was $600,000 approximately, which then was multiplied as money's always, that's invested in a community is always multiplied out. So that was a profit for the community anyway. Invest $400,000, get back $600,000, which was to do with the recycling being sold. I worked out that a big corporate like Waste Management would, they'd get the $400,000 and about, I think it was less than $200,000 would be spent into the community.
Right.
So that was like a net loss for the community.
Yep.
And I thought that was, I found that was the most effective way of describing the difference for the community. And it, it makes sense in retrospect. The corporate, their idea is they don't want to invest in a community. They're there for their shareholders.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they'd be based in Hamilton. They'd have a depot there.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, well, now those shareholders, you know, live in Beijing. So, you know, the money's, you know, is siphoned offshore.
Yeah.
So there's even less benefit for the country. But yeah, we still use kind of your equation, and it's been added to by other studies, and that's exactly right. You know, like at the moment, there's about $800,000 of rate paid services that come into Extreme, and we deposited about $1.6 to $1.8 million a year back into the local community in the same financial year.
Yeah.
So you'll get your service. And to a really high quality, we hope, but we'll double every dollar that you give us in local spending, in wages, contracts, and spending in local shops. So yeah, and that's before the multiplier effect of how many people cash their you know wages and spend it locally. How many
times the money goes round. There's Brian Innes is going to be in town, I think, this month.
Oh, cool.
And he, one time he was here, he showed a graph or a thing about the money flow generally for a small community and how quickly it leaves the community in the form of rates and buying stuff that's not made mortgages. In town and things and mortgages, the banks, not rates, the banks. Yeah. And it was quite frightening.
Mm.
So there's something really significant about being able to do that. And I was just trying to visualize what it would be like if the whole... Well, it's a small business that's owned locally. They're also investing in their own community as well. So,
yeah, very much. Yeah,
it's keeping out the big corporates, I guess, is for your community's financial well-being. But that can be challenging.
Yeah, it is. Yep, you can make the choice, say, to do your shopping in Hamilton or keeping it local.
Yeah,
We've got great shops in Raglan.
So the council relationship, I know eventually it improved with the, I think it was a change of CEO.
Yep.
And a change of, because council is always evolving their staff, a new manager over the waste area. Who was that guy?
Yeah, that was, Richard Bax.
Yeah, Richard Bax. Yeah,
moved in, and he had come from Hamilton City Council. And he had a different view.
He thought recycling was worthwhile.
He did. Yep. He was, you know, it's super hard in a small district council, you know, in Waikato being one of those. And so, for Richard's position, he needed to be an expert in wastewater, roading, and solid waste.
Right.
And really, roading, you know, is like 80% of Waikato District Council's budget. You know, at that time, roading was everything. And so that was the focus. And then beneath that, really, stormwater, drinking water, and sewage was the next biggest issue. So always solid waste was a bit of a tack on the end.
And
didn't have much focus, but Richard saw the issues and gave Extreme Zero Waste a 7-year contract, which enabled us to get a bank loan and to capitalise, get a couple of new trucks and do some much needed improvements to the Resource Recovery Centre.
Yeah, and now no one would expect the Resource Recovery Centre to start with nothing like you guys did. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, if you want it to succeed.
Yeah. And so did you imagine when you opened on 2000, did you imagine what's there now? Could you see that far ahead?
I guess in some ways we could, because we put everything in piles, you know, and some of you would have remembered, you know, the initial pile of wood that we had, which
yeah,
was,
remember,
was 200 meters long, you know, and that volume of wood, you know, once I mean, we always made the argument to council that it would be cheaper to build a building so that we could process all of the wood that came in than it would be to landfill it, and that, you know, wasn't a shared
opinion.
So it was necessary for us to create this pile. So that was 1 year's worth of wood, you know, and it was 200 meters long, you know, about 5 meters wide and 4 meters high, and that would have cost about $15,000 to actually landfill. And so we said, okay, well, why not invest $15,000 into a building, and we can process the majority of that wood. And then once again, we used the $15,000 from Waikato District Council, and we found another funder, I think Well Energy, and has got some more money, and we built that building there and started processing all of the windows and the doors and the native timber and usable links. By kind of realizing the volume that Raglan was actually creating of each of those things, it was easy to actually visualize that you needed a processing hub for metals and wood, and we still think that there's necessary to have one around textiles, and then the processing of the recyclables and the secondhand shop. So I think, you know, even in our early days, if we had the funding, we would have been able to build something similar to what we have today.
Yeah, but that took, like, the woodyard, just for one, evolved. Like, it wasn't even walled in, that building, to start with. Gradually it got walled in, and then you needed more room, and you've built more.
Yeah.
And it's
sea freight containers, the volume's gone up. But yeah, very much, you know, to Auckland Council have just opened one at Onehunga.
Yeah.
And I was involved in that. And in many ways, it was a funny project, because my great-great-grandfather and great-great-grandmother are both buried in the Waikaraka Cemetery at Onehunga, right beside the area where they're developing this resource recovery centre.
Okay.
And my great great grandfather and grandmother, they were had a family farm there, and that passed down through the generations to my father's generation, finally sold. But it sort of went from Ellerslie down to Onehunga, and I wouldn't mind betting that the farm dump was the start of the Onehunga landfill.
Oh right,
you know,
yeah.
I've got a moral obligation to actually tidy this bloody mess up.
The sins of your ancestors visited upon you.
But, you know, for that site, council, instead of actually contracting the local group to do the work, they've given them a lease agreement for 10 years and a funding agreement for 3 years. But that enabled them to then go to another organisation and say, okay, we've got a funding agreement for this amount of money. Would you match us dollar for dollar? So their initial setup is a sort of a $2.5 million building, right from scratch.
Right.
They haven't even opened the doors, and they've already got this $2.5 million building, massive big concrete floor, super appropriate for the volumes that they will be receiving.
Yeah.
Plus, they've got an education centre and an amazing yard, and it's all perfect and ready for opening, you know.
So what sort of population area is that one going to serve?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. Probably quite a large population area initially, until, you know, some more are established. Waiordia is the next one, and there's also Waitakere. But
so how many community recycling centres would Auckland have ideally?
Yeah, right. What's like the magic number to make it?
Well, I want to get an idea, some idea of, because Extreme Zero Waste serves a community of like 6,000 people, including in the catchment. So, but it must be bigger in Auckland, or do you want every recycle centre to serve 6,000 people in Auckland?
No, we feel that, you know, kind of, 10 to 20,000 people is, you know, or 5 to 20,000 people is a good number for a resource recovery centre. And it's really probably the visitors that come to Raglan, you know, that pop us up to that sort of
true,
level.
True, you know, yeah, summer.
And there's quite a few people from the kind of the rural area that do come out to Extreme. We even know farmers, organic farmers in Ngāra Wahia who kind of save up their recycling, bring it over once a month just because they haven't got access to facilities. So, but, yeah, for Auckland, there was a desktop exercise done, and Warren Snow again and Jerry Gillespie were involved, and they kind of said that 65 resource recovery centres would be perfect for Auckland.
Okay.
And Auckland Council said, that's never going to happen. You know, that's just...
Well, let's talk about this, because councils like to centralise everything. It's easier to and more efficient to administrate one contract with one person who does one centralised thing. Yep. So how hard was it for Auckland Council to get their head around this distributed kind of approach?
Okay, so Auckland Council have always had a goal of waste minimisation.
Yeah.
And they've really progressive, and they've actually got a goal of zero waste by 2040. And so another 18 years. And they've written, over the last 20 years, they've written into their contracts with the large international waste companies, waste diversion and waste minimisation as one of those key goals.
Yeah.
And they've not received any waste minimisation. In fact, their waste has escalated and throughout those contracts.
Well, it's not in the business interest to minimise.
No, well, they own the landfills. So,
yeah, and they'll get less money if they minimise the usage of their service. Yeah.
So this conversation came up with the community. If you're going to reach a goal of zero waste by 2040, you know, how are you going to actually do it? And if it's about behaviour change, then you've got to involve community. And so this plan was to develop some of the transfer stations into resource recovery centres. So initially they set up a goal of having 10 of them, and they've extended that because of the success of them. They've extended it to 21 centres. So we'll see at the end of 21, you know, whether they're keen to go for more.
Well, by that time you might have a generation of managers in Auckland Council who just think this is how it's done. Like it's become normalised.
Yep.
Which is often the biggest challenge.
Yeah, agree.
I think, yeah. Well, that's so... What about, like it's easy in Raglan to see the community came together in a town hall and a community group formed out of it. It's really easy to identify the community here because we're, you know, there's a point on the map and it's all there. And the parts of Auckland, have you been able to find the key people who want to do a community recycle centre and can see the benefits and have the energy for it, the desire, the passion?
Yeah, some of it. So there's a number of kind of map overlays, and one of which is existing asset. You know, so okay. Auckland City have got X amount of transfer stations or pieces of land like the Ōnehunga landfill that they have available to develop into a resource recovery centre. But they're running out of, or they've run out now of that asset, and so all of the future ones will be more about partnerships with Māori, with church, with Pacifica, with farmers, you know, other creatives. But one of the other overlays is the kind of socioeconomic. Other ones are around culture, and then the geography. So there's just places in Auckland where people kind of hang and have a reason to focus their energy.
Yeah.
And so what we found, like Ōnihanga is actually a partnership between Localize, which is the Zero Waste Network organisation, and a Samoan community enterprise.
Right.
And so their desire is to actually build something which is quite different, and it will focus on the resources which it's predominantly Samoan Tongan community wants, and also they're having a think about, well, what is modular housing, and is it possible that we can actually use some of the resources here to send back up to the islands?
Okay.
Especially after the last hurricane.
Yeah, well, they're a regular event
over
the islands, as we know. Yeah. Okay, well, that's... Yeah, it's kind of a visioning. It's definitely necessary to be able to envisage a future. What is Extreme's future at this point? Like, it's clearly a resource recovery centre, and it's operating and having a really high diversion rate. What happens next, do you think?
Yeah, well, it's such a cool crew, and Steve, Nikki, and Nina, and but you know, the whole crew that's coming through. I mean, there will be a few changes. You know, we've Extreme really needs to morph as our community changes. So at the moment, we're having a massive pulse of construction and demolition material.
Yeah.
You know, from new housing as well as the deconstruction of old housing.
I don't think that's going to stop. I mean, the country's dead short of houses, and it will be for decades, I think. So,
And coastal communities as well, probably, you know.
Everyone wants to live here.
Yeah, everyone wants to live here. So we've... So it's got to Extreme's got to have the flexibility to be able to morph and expand in the construction demolition area, and then, you know, probably another one which is on the horizons is textiles. And textiles might not feature if you're looking at volume or weight, but it does when you talk about carbon. And the amount of carbon that it takes to actually produce textiles is huge. It's off the scale. It's way more important to deal with textile issues than it is with aluminium, you know.
Okay.
So in my view, you know, it's natural that that's, once again, using these kind of overlays, has become more interested in carbon and climate change, then we can look at the waste streams and go, okay, well, which ones are the best bang for buck? And as we said, you know, food waste collections services has become a rateable activity as of the 1st of July. And we thank Raglan's community for supporting that.
Yeah.
But it would have been mandatory in 2 years' time from the central government, because the emissions from organics going to landfill is so huge, you know, that it's, we've got to get the organics out of the landfills, and emissions will become a major driver. So textiles will become important. So, you know, once again, you know, we've got such amazing creative people in Raglan, you know, the Di Jennings, you know, the Sarah Lancasters. Imagine if we had a hub up there, you know, where we could deconstruct and reconstruct textiles.
We have artists who do that already, so.
Totally.
Yeah.
Let's give them a funky home.
There are several community recyclers who've had their contract whisked out from under their feet, even in recent years. Is that eventually going to stop? Like, I know Wanaka Wastebusters had a while ago. Waiheke, they lost theirs at one point. Seabeck and Kaitaia lost theirs, which was unbelievable. And the mayor actually admitted some years later that was a mistake.
Yeah.
I think community recycling centres are a far better way to do things than the corporate sector doing it. Is that going to become the way of doing it, or are we always going to have this battle?
Yeah, I definitely think council procurement is changing. And for Auckland Council, the weighted attributes are up to 75% and only 25% based on cost.
So this is their decision-making matrix that they use. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So they've also got a quota. You know, they're saying, okay, well, of all of the contracts that Auckland Council was going to procure for this next year, 10% must go to Māori, 10% must go to Pacifica. I'm just making up these figures, but they're roughly about that.
Right. But that 10 to 15%. There's something like that.
Yeah. And something like 20% must go to community enterprises.
Right.
So they're actually seeing that that's our, you know, responsibility in terms of the treaty. That's our responsibility in terms of the identity of Auckland being the largest Pacific city.
Yeah.
And and we know the benefits of working through the community enterprise model. So this is, we're going to increase this type of business and decrease the amount of business that we do through international corporates. And so that's one side of it. A week or so ago, I went for a tour of a resource recovery centre, which is in Hamilton and run by Waste Management.
Yeah.
And it was the most amazing centre. It had this huge shop, like four times bigger than Extreme Zero Waste. And it had car washing facilities, and it had massive big covered area for recycling. And the manager there said, we're all about diversion. Getting resource consent for new landfills is so difficult these days.
Right.
It's so expensive.
Yeah.
We are going to go for a higher cost per square meter in our landfills from now on. And so diversion is going to become a core activity of Waste Management.
Well, this is one of the things that recycling was considered to be this hippie-ish activity, but it actually makes the capitalist economy more efficient. Efficient use of resources. Like, it's actually a very sensible thing to do from that perspective as well.
But
is that good that Waste Management are they going to try and take over all the community recycling centers one day?
Well, you know, have we done our job? Is resource recovery normalized to the point where the large corporates are actually see it as you know, core business?
I would expect, though, that the community recyclers would get a higher diversion rate because first of all, corporate have to siphon off 15% of their income for profits, whereas the community recyclers can use that to recycle things that are borderline profitable or below profitable. Is that still happening?
Yeah, and I think at the moment it's kind of a bit of a loss leader, you know, for Waste Management. This is just my interpretation.
Yes.
And it's more about gaining higher traffic numbers through their transfer station, and where they're still making the money is on landfilling.
Yeah.
And that's just fine. You know, that's I guess what I'm saying is that this business is not exclusive to community and everyone can participate, and we're going to see lots of hybrid models where councils will actually say what we actually want to procure is minimising emissions, minimising transportation and once again emissions, maximum diversion of waste from landfill or incineration, and investing in local economy. So they'll all become drivers, and we'll see corporates going, oh, want to do a bit of a joint venture, Zero Waste Network?
We've got some funding, because it's easy for them to access funding, it would seem. Yeah, they've always got investors on tap.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We're sort of, we are kind of out of time, but I wanted to just say, not what's the future for Extreme? What's the future for Raglan? People are always talking Raglan's changing, and it's all a bit of doom and gloom, you know, that when people say a place is changing.
Yep.
But I know that you're able to see the possibilities in things. I didn't prepare you with this question, but what do you see for Raglan in the future?
Yeah, I think it's you know, a special little town. It's the growth that we're seeing is not unique to Raglan. You know, it's unique to all coastal towns in this country.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, you know, we need to sift through and decide, you know, what are the most important elements that we want to keep. You know, what is the kind of vibe of Raglan, and how do we maintain that with growth. And you know, and And yes, there are issues around sort of socioeconomics and the ability to be able to live here in Raglan with property prices. But I think Raglan, you know, we've got really high literacy and high involvement in community activity and environmental activity. And I know of people who've come into this community, you know, and have brought money with them, but they want the same things for their kids. They want a safe place to live. They want a community, you know, that's progressive and takes their responsibilities as a treaty partner seriously, looks after the environment, and so, you know, they want to live here, and that, and you can't buy that with money. You know, that's something about investing your time, and I still feel positive about the future. You know, I think it's difficult when it's a lot of the activity is actually managed by local council, and particularly around subdivisions. You know, and we need to be brave about making decisions about enough's enough, because we have got some finite resources like fresh water, the ability to deal with our wastes, whether they be liquid or solid.
Yeah.
And you know, to me, you know, it's how many people are in the queue at the coffee, or how many people are in the queue at the one-way bridge, as to whether I, you know, go to the beach for the day, or and we just can't make radical changes, you know, and increase the size of the CBD. So you know, we need to get brave about making some decisions about what are the limits in terms of numbers of dwellings in this area.
Yeah. So, folks, we've been talking to Rick Thorpe, no longer on the staff at Extreme after 22 years or 24 years recycling, really. Do you feel satisfied with the job done?
Oh, I'm stoked. There's such an amazing team up there. Yeah, they're going to rock and roll. You know, I've been a handbrake, you know. It's, they'll be amazing. And,
was it a good thing to do with your life?
Totally. Yeah. No regrets.
Yeah. Because I've done some things in my life that I'm kind of proud to be associated with, but I'm kind of envious that you got to start something like that and been able to leave it and see it, you know, you're safe in the knowledge that it'll progress for the future. So,
yeah, thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, tip my hat to that.
Oh, well, those 450 people, we all made a contribution.
Everyone did.
Yeah, good support from Raglan community.
Yeah. All right, Rick, thanks for coming in this morning.